If you listen to one podcast this year about your money, make it this one, because I'm joined by the author of the books Money Rules 101 and 50 Ways to Flourish After Divorce. The financial coach, Patty Handy, has nearly 4 decades in financial services. Patty is an incredible woman who helps you to achieve peace of mind and financial confidence. In this episode, we talk all about what it's really costing you not knowing how to manage your money or having the confidence. We talked about how do you talk to your kids about money the right way. We talked about money mindset and confidence in building wealth, limiting beliefs. We talked about having money dates with your partner and the mechanics of investing, not to mention some great tips on how you can choose the right investment fund for you. So if you're going to listen to one podcast this year about money, make sure it's this one. Well, welcome to the Lifestyle Entrepreneur Show with me, Sue Parker. Today, I'm joined by Patty Handy, who discovers how she can help women to transform their finances and life so that they can achieve financial confidence and peace of mind. So this topic is a big one. It's money. It's all about the reasons that we use as an excuse not to do the thing that we love. Patty, thank you so much for joining us here on the Lifestyle Entrepreneur Show.
Thank you, Sue. I appreciate you having me. Happy to be here.
So tell us, how did you get into the work of financial confidence and helping these women to achieve peace of mind with their finances?
You know, this journey has been somewhat of a long one. The seed was planted right after my divorce. I was divorced when my son was 18 months old. And I remember the angst and the fear and the overwhelm and just the emotional trauma of a divorce. And then I had the trauma of having, doing this life alone and managing the money and managing just, you know, everything, work and the whole kit and caboodle. And I was the money person in my marriage. My ex-husband didn't know anything about investing or managing money. So I felt comfortable with that aspect. However, I still felt it was very scary alone. And I remember once I got out of the fog and the darkness of that time, I remember thinking, I'm going to someday take this experience and help women who I know are uncomfortable with this and give them this confidence and give them the strength to make these decisions on their own. So I went on, post-divorce to get into the mortgage business. And then I was a financial advisor. And then I went into financial coaching. I left my job as a financial advisor last year in 2023, and I became a financial coach for women. And it was basically, it was birthed, 20 something years ago when I, post-divorce. But the seed grew over the years when I was speaking with clients in the mortgage business and in the financial business. I was meeting with women who just were very fearful and overwhelmed. And there was a lot of embarrassment, a lot of shame around money. And I thought, this is just crazy. We need to stop this. We're not addressing this problem. And so, I'm all about educating and empowering women and having them become just badass investors.
So you said you went into mortgages and then into being a financial advisor. So you come now from a finance background.
Yes. Even pre-marriage, I was in corporate banking. So after college, I graduated with an accounting degree. I was in corporate banking for many, many years and then had my son. And then I went into mortgage lending because it allowed me to work at home and have flexibility. I didn't want to go back to my corporate job and leave my son all day. So I was able to work around a schedule, have flexibility. So it was a beautiful thing. I had that flexibility and that option, which was great.
It sounds like you had a lot of education around finances, which really helped you in that time. But I can imagine that you meet lots of people who don't have that. I mean, you touched on some of the things there, but what is it really costing us by not having financial mastery?
It's costing us on so many levels. Financially, from a pure numbers perspective, if we don't understand some of the basics, it's costing us pure dollars. It's costing us, money. And we as women are already, somewhat behind the eight ball because we are, we're earning less than men. We are spending time as caretakers. We're raising kids. So we're out of the workforce. So our Social Security is less. I mean, it's on and on about how we as women are already entering retirement, with less than most men. So it's costing us in real dollars. It's also costing us in peace of mind. It's the sleepless nights. I've heard over and over from women, the number one fear is I don't want to be a burden to my kids, and I'm afraid of running out of money. Those are the two most common things that I hear, and it's just the, the lack of understanding, the lack of knowledge. And once I help them find that and teach that, it's like, wow, that was easier than I thought. I get this now. This is fantastic.
Wow.
So, it's costing us emotionally, and then of course, physically, we're not well because we're emotionally stressed. And I mean, it's just this vicious cycle. So yes, it's costing us on almost every level in our world.
It's interesting that you say that because, on the one hand, you think money, wealth, and I believe we're going to come to this, but there's a lot of mindset around it being an evil thing. It's a bad thing to want more. But what you're saying here is most people aren't saying, I want a beach house in California. Most people aren't saying, I want to live wealthy, rich, and have a helicopter. This isn't an element of greed or materialism going on. It sounds like this is simply about saying financial security. To
Yes.
know that I can be independent of anybody else for the rest of my life, which is kind of a fundamental need now in a modern society. It's not like we can do without it, and there's no greed going on it. But I would imagine what you see is a lot of people having poor relationships with money because of that association that money equals greed, wealth equals all of these negative things. But I mean, what do you see? So what is
Yeah.
going on for these women? Not just the education, but in their mindset.
Yes, that's a great question. So the mindset is huge. It really is the foundational side of money. I can teach anybody how to invest. I could teach them how to manage the money. I could teach them about spending. We could have these conversations. The mechanics of money are actually quite easy. It's the foundational side of our limiting beliefs. And essentially, and this conversation can go for an hour in itself, but essentially, from birth to about age eight, we were a sponge. We were an open brain, if you will, and we heard our parents talk about things. We heard grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, coaches, whoever, and we absorbed what they said as truth, as reality, which then became our limiting beliefs. So if we were in a home that spoke of, rich people are greedy, you only get rich if you hurt somebody else, there is, people who want a lot of money just, want to buy material items. It's not about that. It's about security, safety, peace of mind. And I always say that, money makes you more what you already are. If you are a generous, loving, giving person, more money makes you more generous and loving. If you're a greedy jerk, you're going to be a bigger greedier jerk, right? But that does not mean that, money makes you evil. It is about, but the love of money for wanting power and control, that's not good. But if you want money because you want to be able to give and you want to be able to, help your family out and you want to, be generous and philanthropic, there's so many things you can do with money. It gives you choices, it gives you freedom. So, no, money is not evil. But if you heard growing up that money is evil, that's what is a tape recorder playing in your subconscious mind. And that's the thing that we have to address. And we have to poke holes in the limiting beliefs, which then create our thoughts, which then create our actions, which then create our results. So if you look at your life and you're not happy with the results of your life, you need to look at what might be going on in your subconscious mind that is a bunch, just a bunch of baloney.
Yeah, I love that. We did an episode recently about the temperature gauge that you have. So if you're used to being in
Yeah.
your overdraft, you're going to keep going in your overdraft. And every
Yes.
time you get away from that red line limit, just enough that you feel comfortable again, but you're still comfortable in your overdraft, you're going to do it every month. You're just going to keep doing it. And to get
Yeah.
out of that and to be used to being abundant and having a £10,000 cash flow is quite a shift. Somebody's got to mentally make with their temperature gauge. Patty, you talked about, and I'm a mum, and I know some of our listeners have got nieces, nephews, or kids themselves. And I'm always wondering, how do you do this? How do you have this conversation? Because my kids want everything. They see the adverts, they want everything. And I'm always conscious of not giving the message that money is evil, but I'm never sure whether you give the message that says, you can't have everything, money doesn't grow on trees, but how do you give the message that says, well, you can one day probably have most of the things you want and need, but you have to earn it. Do you know what I mean? What is the,
yes.
like, what should I say when my kids are constantly asking for stuff and they've had a lot of stuff? And because I've done it where some, for months on end, I might have given them almost everything they've asked for because we're abundant. We've got the money around us. You know, it's not like when I was a kid and we didn't have it. Scarcity was around, or a wartime child. You know, our kids are very lucky. We can pretty much give them most things, and we'll sacrifice our own things, let's face it, for them. But, you know, you do that. And then 6 months down the line, you look back and you go, they're not grateful or appreciative or caring or look after or respect any of this stuff. All I'm doing is spoiling them. So then yeah. You're back to, okay, now I'm going to start saying no. But when I start saying no, what's the language to use that's safe, that still tells them this is kind of abundant and it's okay? What would you say?
That's a great question. So it all comes down to language. So rather than saying something like, you know, we can't afford that, or, you know, no, you can't have this right now, we don't have the money for it, it's using the language of, that isn't a good use of our money right now. That puts you back in control of, you have the money, but it isn't the best use of that money. I'd rather see that money being invested for your college, or perhaps a trip that we're going to go on as a family. It's better, you know, that. Or you can say something like, that's a great thing to want, good for you. How do you think you can earn money to buy it yourself? Because you have you have the ability to earn whatever you want. Now, if you have younger kids, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, and they can't go get a job, you can say, you know what? I will pay you $1 if you vacuum the house. Or I will pay you £1. I'm in the state, so I use dollar. I will pay you, you know, whatever amount you want to pay them for each chore that they do. I'm a big believer. I'm kind of going against the norm here. I'm not a big believer in allowance. You know, I don't get an allowance as an adult just because I'm here. I get an allowance, so to speak, an income for my work that I do, whether it's being self-employed or I go to a job. So you can teach your kids, yes, you can, you know, do what you want. You've got to earn it. And, you know, being in this household, there are basic requirements. You've got to fix your bed. You got to keep your room clean. You've got to help mom and dad with, you know, setting the table at dinner time or whatever it is that you have in your house as far as certain chores. And you're not getting paid for that. That's just part of being in this family unit. And we all work together for us as a family. But there's extra things, you know, washing cars, vacuuming the house, dusting, taking the dogs for a walk, whatever it is you want to come up with. And you can say, I'll give you $2 for that, or $1 for that, or whatever. And then they can earn that money, and they realize how hard it is to earn it. And then they realize how hard it is to, well, wait a minute, if I've got to work this hard for $5 or £5 or whatever, and my thing I want is 10, it's like, okay, I got to work really hard. Good. This is good for them to know. This is good for them to realize that, yeah, life isn't about just flying by and being entitled to whatever you want. You've got to work for it. And that's the message that we send, along with the language of, yes, there's possibilities and there's abundance out there everywhere. There's opportunities everywhere for you. Let's just go find them, or you go find them. And I have to tell you a funny story. When I was young, so I come from a family of 5 kids, and my dad was the full-time worker. My mom was raising us 5 kids. And, you know, very young, they said, if you want something, you've got to go figure out a way to earn it. So at 9 years old, I created a little candy stand in my neighborhood and I sold candy bars to the neighborhood kids because I love candy. Who doesn't, right? And I thought, well, if I love candy, all the other kids do too. And so I started selling candy bars at 9, and it taught me to respect money. So there you go.
Oh, that's great. You've given us some really great language there to use. Yeah, that isn't a good use of our money right now. Or yeah, you can earn it. And we definitely do that. I mean, over here we might call it pocket money, but you're right. I don't give pocket money for nothing. Our kids, they earn it by having, you know, a good school report, or, you know, doing something, having a bunch of stickers in their book, or yeah, helping out at the house, whatever they do. So I love that, Patty. Thank you so much for giving us some practical stuff. All right, so back to us. As grown-ups, we should know how to manage our money right now, but we don't. So what are the biggest mistakes that you see us make? Like the first thing when you're looking at somebody's situation, you can just spot them a mile off. They're doing the same thing that everybody's doing. What is it? What are we doing?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is not paying attention to the details. I think that we are getting caught up in, well, first of all, let me go back and just say, give yourself some grace. A lot of times we beat ourselves up for not knowing this. And we say, oh, and I hear this language from women all the time. I should know this. Why don't I know this? I'm really embarrassed. You know, I'm like, well, you never, never taught it. You didn't learn it in school. You didn't learn it at home. So how are you expected to learn it? Let's just start today and move forward and just get rid of that shame word. You know, there's just no use for that here. But when I say pay attention to the details, I mean, let's look at what's coming in and what's going out. You know, take a look at, I mean, it's kind of basic. It's simple, but it's also very, very crucial. What do we have coming in? Whether it's from a W-2, whether it's from our company, whether it's Social Security, a pension, whatever it is that we have coming in. And then what's going out? Where's our money going every month? How are we spending it? Now, I know people don't like the word budget, but I think it gives us some power and control if we understand where our money is going. And then we can see where the leak in the hole in the boat is, you know, what's leaking out where. And so when we realize that, oh gosh, you know, we're spending this much money here when we can really use that money to put it into an emergency fund or an investment account or a travel fund or whatever it is, that helps us kind of really feel in control of our finances. And then the other thing is just being fearful of the unknown of investing. You know, investing is this big, scary thing in the sky, and it really isn't. You know, the basics are understanding, you know, funds, and the types of funds, and looking at expense ratios, looking at performance, and looking at how you want to allocate your assets based on your situation. You know, how old are you? When do you need that money? All of those aspects. That's what we go through, you know, in coaching. But it really is quite simple. It's just, you just need to learn it initially. And then once you learn it, you got it.
Wow, you just said some big scary words for most people. Assets, income ratio. I wrote one of them down and I was like, I don't know. Okay, so to wind back to the details, one of the things that we did as a couple that I found was really enlightening is reluctantly we kept spending diaries. And it really helped us to address, because in a couple, you can have the blame thing going on. The other thing going on. It's you that's the problem. You're the one that spends all the money. And then when you have a spending diary, there's no hiding. We had to write down everything we were spending everywhere. And it highlighted things like too many takeaways or takeouts, you know, too much of this, too much of that. Actually, I don't want to be funding somebody else's Range Rover down at the local takeaway. And it sorts of reassess what you're spending your money on. We also, we had to do it for bigger items over the year as well, ones that you pay for once a year or once every 6 months, because what we realized is you didn't attribute like a monthly cost, or you didn't look at your salary and go, well, of that salary, that 60, 70K I'm earning, I'm actually spending a good £2,000 of that on haircuts or something, or hairdressers. And it's like, realize that £2,000 of the money I was earning every year that I'm being taxed on, I'm pouring it out to a hairdresser. But at least when you know that, you can you can make the decision whether you want to still do it or whether, you know, you actually wanted to put that money somewhere else. We sort of looked at day trips and things as well as a family. It was very expensive to have day trips. And we realized too many of these day trips meant we weren't having the big city break trips that were on our bucket list. So we kind of shifted some of our focus there. We're going to have a few weekends at home so we can have this big trip to Paris, which we found really valuable. But
that's
anyway,
awesome.
I digress.
I love it. I know, I love it. And that spending diary is perfect. That it's a, you know, I call it, I have a spending tracker, and it's the same. It's basically the same, you know, theory. It's just watching those monies and looking at where it's going and identifying where you can pull back, and doing it as a couple is beautiful. I always say that couples should have a money date, like once a quarter, where they go out for dinner or they go to a park and they have a picnic or something, you know, not super expensive. And they just talk about their finances. Let's, you know, are we on track? Are we okay? Are we getting out of debt? If there is debt, are we saving enough? Are we on track in our retirement? You know, what of our, you know, and have that conversation, then it doesn't become the scary, uncomfortable, evil thing. And, you know, God forbid, and I say this sometimes because I've had some of, you know, my clients with a spouse pass unexpectedly. And, you know, the spouse left, typically the woman is, oh my gosh, I don't even know what to do. I don't know where to start. And so if you have these money dates that, you know, not that you're living in fear, but, you know, you just have that empowerment knowing that whatever happens, you can take care of things. And so that money date is super important. So good for you. And that's great.
Yeah, great, great idea. Then you talked about lots of things about not being scared about investing. And I want to get into that. Earlier on, you mentioned that the mechanics are very simple. What do you have, like a simple way of explaining the mechanics of investing for us?
Yeah, so usually when I do like a meeting, it's a Zoom, and I will share my screen and I'll jump on to like a Fidelity or a Vanguard or a Schwab or one of those investment bank investment management companies, and I will show them how to look at the funds. And I'll tell them, okay, here's the definition of a mutual fund. Here's a ETF, which is an exchange traded fund, and here's an index fund, and here's the differences between the funds. An index fund is usually passively managed, so it's less expensive. So the expense ratios are lower. That means more money in your pocket. And I show them how to look at the expense ratios once we log on to that account. Then I tell them to look at the performance. We look at the, you know, 1, 3, 5, 10 year performance of that particular fund. And it's super important to understand that, you know, how well it has been performing. And then to keep it, you know, simple. We don't have to understand individual stocks. We don't need to, you know every single fund out there. There's hundreds, thousands of funds. I don't know all these funds. There's no way. So you pick some, like, you know, in the States, there's the S&P 500, Standard & Poor's 500 index fund. That is a fund that invests in 500, you know, companies. So it's very well diversified. They take care of the diversification. They take care of managing that fund. I don't need to go and pick all the individual stocks. That's just, you know, statistically, it shows that, you know, those ones that are diversified for you do quite well. So we talk about some of that.
Okay. It's good that you're saying this, because I feel that we've probably all heard, you know, Warren Buffett. There's also a lot of people, experts, I listen to Warren Buffett. This is what you should do. And a resounding repeated phrase is always around, you know, don't invest in something you don't understand, you don't know. Right. And I guess that in itself, you're like, okay, that makes sense. But how much do I need to know? Like, do I need to research that company and everything about it? And then it's scary. And then you go, actually, I haven't got time right now to research every single one of these companies. So are you therefore saying that if you stick with one of these, you know, what do they call them? Index funds or something that's, or all of these just combined funds, basically across lots of different companies?
Yeah, the funds are very diversified. You have many different types of funds. You can invest in various sectors. So if you like technology, there's a slew of technology funds. If you like healthcare, if you like the energy sector, if you like, you know, whatever it is, hospitality, I mean, there's many to choose from. So if you like that industry, that sector, you can put a portion of your investments in that sector. Technology has been, you know, doing very, very well for quite a while. Then we had the tech bust, you know, so it's like one of those things you've got to just watch. Like I mentioned earlier, the S&P 500 is a combination of, you know, some tech, some healthcare, some hospitality, some, you know, it's well, again, I'm going to use that word diversified kind of too much, but that's what you really want. You've got to be mindful and be careful of what you're investing in. And then also it depends on when you are going to need those funds. So if you are looking at, if you're 25 years old and you've got decades before you retire, you can afford to put more in the market and be a little bit more aggressive than if you were 65 and getting ready to retire. Your allocation would be very, very different at 65 than it would be at 25. So yes, that's something that you want to be mindful of. You had one other question, and I'm not sure I addressed it. I'm having a blank. What was the other question you asked intertwined with that?
I think you did.
Did I?
Okay. I guess in the UK, so we have the FTSE 100 is kind of like the top 100 companies. Okay. And that's a really good example of probably the closest to the S&P 500, maybe. And then you said there's mutual funds, there's ETF funds, and there's index funds.
Yes.
And is one of the, are there sort of low risk and high risk in each of those buckets?
So it's really... A mutual fund is, I'm going to explain it like this, and which is true of, well, okay. A mutual fund is like a box of chocolates. You go into your chocolate candy store, okay, and you buy a box of chocolates that has all the different flavors in there, right? It's like a box of chocolates. A mutual fund has all the different companies inside of it. So you're buying this fund that invests in all these different companies, which is much like an index fund. They're investing in the index. The mutual funds are actively managed, which means there's active portfolio managers who are trading in and out of different companies and managing that very actively. So those tend to be a little bit more expensive in terms of the expense ratio, which means it's much less money in your pocket because the expense ratio is higher. An index fund is less, is more passively managed. They're investing in the index, not in these all these, you know, individual companies. So the expense ratio is lower. So I love index funds. An ETF, an exchange traded fund, is an index fund that trades like a stock, meaning that if you buy it at 1201 and you trigger a buy or a sale order, it's going to hit at the moment, the next, you know, the moment that that you trigger it. So it's like a stock. If you go buy Apple at, you know, again, 1201, it's going to trigger at that price after you hit the buy or the sell. If you, assuming you do a market order, that's a key term. But if you buy a mutual fund or an index fund, that is trading at the end of the day. So if you buy it at 1201, that sale or buy won't trigger till the end of the trading day. So you don't know what price you're paying until the end of the day. So that's kind of where the ETF separates. And I remember what I was thinking earlier that I wanted to say, you were talking about not investing in things you don't understand. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to understand everything about every company, but it's good to understand what fund you're investing in and what they invest in. That's why I'm super, super cautious when somebody's buying an insurance product or an annuity. There are so many moving parts to those types of products, and they can be very complicated. So unless you don't understand it, and I always say that if you can't teach this to a fourth grader, if you can't learn it well enough and comfortable enough to teach it to a fourth grader, you probably shouldn't be investing in it in yourself. You need to really understand all the nuances, all the hidden fees, all the expenses, all the penalties that you can be incurred if you sell out early. What's truly involved in understanding the highs and the lows, the pros and the cons, versus just taking your money and buying a separate term life insurance policy and buying a fund to take care of the insurance piece and the investment piece. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to insurance and annuity, yes, you need to understand pretty much everything.
Mm. Thank you for that. That's really valuable. Okay, so back to investment funds. In a nutshell, mutuals, I use the word higher fees because that's the term that I use with our investments. So mutuals, slightly higher fees, index probably lower fees. You call it an income ratio or something, didn't you?
Expense ratios. Yeah.
That was the one. Okay. I think I'm getting it.
Okay.
I think we're starting to get it. So the next question is, do you need a financial advisor to do this? Should you have a financial advisor always picking these things for you? Or, and I think what I'm hearing is, if you're confident enough and you do your homework and check the things that you coach people to do, then people can do this themselves, most people.
They can absolutely do this themselves if they understand what they're doing. The time and place where an advisor comes in, and I'm pro-advisor. A lot of what I do complements a financial advisor. If there's a lot of moving parts, like you've got a bunch of rental properties, if you have a lot of tax, things to consider, if you've got a lot of estate planning aspects to it, you want to have somebody that understands all of that and can work together with those other experts in your world. So that financial advisor would work with your estate planning attorney, with your CPA or your tax preparer, and come up with, a plan to put into place. There could be some lost opportunities if you have a lot of moving parts and you don't know about these things. And, it would make sense for you to pay for a financial advisor. Sometimes when you're starting out, financial advisors have a minimum, portfolio size before they work with you. So, look for that. A lot of these big brokerage companies like Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, you can work with the advisors there without a minimum. So there's pros and cons to it both. Certainly you're going to pay for the advisor. But if, you're saving, if it's costing you $10,000 a year to hire an advisor, but they're saving you $20,000 or pounds because of your tax savings and the strategies that they're putting in place for you that you wouldn't have even known otherwise, then it makes sense.
Patty, there's one thing we've not talked about, and that is knowing what the goal is. So how did, let's say, you know, somebody's listening, they're in their 40s, they know they need to get a handle on their finances, they've not done a great deal of investing or pension work up till this point. How do they figure out what the goal is to then work back to, right, this is what I need to do now? How do you know what that goal is? Because
yeah,
stuff could be, you know, inflation's happening. We don't know what house prices are going to be. What are, do you know what I mean? There's so many unknowns. How do you get people to start by figuring out the goal?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, it's like taking a trip. You have to know your end destination before you can plan the roadmap to get there, right? So you have to decide what that end destination means and what that looks like for you. So whether that's retiring at 55 or 50 or 65 or 70 or whatever that number is for you, you want to look at what that looks like. Can you work, you know, if you decide you want to retire at 70, will you work part-time after that just to stay active and stay social? You know, that's always good. And what kind of income can you generate from that? What does it look like in terms of where I want to live? Do I want to move from a, you know, where I live now to a different place? Do I want to downsize? What monthly nut can I afford every single month once I do retire? And what does that look like? So what am I getting with Social Security or pension or any other income that I'm getting when I retire? And what, how much will that offset against what my monthly nut will be? Now, we can't project what our monthly nut will be in 40 years. We have no idea, like you said, where houses will be. Unless you own a home outright today and you're gonna, this is your forever home, then you kind of have an idea what your monthly nut is, but you have taxes, insurance, other aspects that, you know, can change. So we do kind of the best projection that we can with that. But you go ahead, you had a question?
So I was just thinking inflation in terms of food shopping and electric and gas. Do you have, are there calculations or something that people can do to work, estimate what that might be in the future?
Yeah, so working with a financial planner, when I was working in that field, we had a software program, and it we, it basically put in our expenses today, and then it would project based on inflation, you know, inflationary numbers, what that number would look like in, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. So, you know, it was a projected number. You know, currently, you know, we're at 3.5% inflation. A year ago, we were at 8 or 9. So, you know, things change. So we basically take an average of what that projected inflation number would look like. And then we kind of do that fast forwarding into that analysis. So yes, there is software. You can put in all of your expenses today, all of your situation today, your house, your income expenses, the whole nine yards. And then I want to retire at 75. This is my income at this time. You know, how healthy is my plan? And it'll go through this whole gyration calculation and it'll spit out a number. It's like your plan is 40% healthy, which is not good. You know, you want to be at 100%. So you then play with the numbers by either cutting back your expenses or saving more money between now and the time you retire, being more aggressive with your savings, getting to a point where you can get to a healthier number. We want to see it at 70, 75% or more in terms of the health of the plan. And that's done through a software program that most financial advisors do have.
Okay. So you'd need to go through a financial advisor to do that. There's nothing online that people can just download or how to take a look at.
I don't believe so. There was some talk of some. I haven't found one. That's a good question. I should probably research that a little bit further and see if there are some. I think, you know, part of the problem is that you have to know how to work the software. Because if you put crap in, crap comes out.
Yeah, garbage so, in, garbage out. Yeah.
Yeah. If you, that was a much prettier word. Thank you. If you don't know how to, you know, use the program and that software, whatever you put in, it's going to give you maybe a false sense of security or a false fear. So that's where the advisors who know how to work this program and know what questions to ask and, you know, where to poke around can help you kind of navigate that. Mm-hmm.
So Patty, you work with a lot of women as a financial coach. Could you maybe share with us one common sort of thing that a woman would come with you and come to you with a problem or with something they want to achieve, their goal? And what is like the first step you would give them to start them off on that journey? Give us a sense for how what it's like being coached by you, basically.
Yeah, great. So it depends on, you know, my clients come in at all different places in their life. Some come in Most of the women that I work with are either divorced or widowed, and they're basically doing life alone. And so they're needing that guidance, you know, from the get-go. There are some clients who had things kind of in place, but just want to make sure that they were doing things right and they were on track. But as a financial coach, I also do a lot of life coaching. It's all kind of intertwined. So we have lots of conversations where we don't talk about money at all. It's just about things in life. I had a client who she was an executive coach, and she had an opportunity to bid on a very large project, and she was kind of stalling and dragging her feet, and for whatever reason. And we sort of unpacked, and this kind of came back to the mindset thing. We unpacked, you know, I kind of asked the questions, unpacked a lot of the things that were going on because I knew something was up. And come to find out, you know, as a child, she was told by her mom to keep quiet a lot. So she was kind of playing in that small place, if you will. And once she stepped into her greatness, she, you know, it was a whole different beautiful outcome. But basically we start with where they're at. You know, if it's kind of at the beginning, I have them gather all their documents, you know, credit card statements, bank statements. I want to understand exactly what's coming in and what's going out. We put together this budget. We look at their investments. We look at how things are allocated. We talk about, you know, what they should consider. I have to be very careful that I don't advise. Like, I can't tell them to, oh, put 10% of your funds in this fund, because then I'm walking into the financial advisory role again, and I can't do that. But I can help them understand what's right and what's wrong and what to do. And then if they work with an advisor, here's the questions to ask the advisor. And then when they work with the advisor and the advisor starts using the language, they know the language, they understand what's being spoken, and it's a much better conversation because they feel empowered and they feel confident. And they also come to a place of comfort saying to an advisor, you know what, I don't understand what you just said. Can you say it differently and slow down, please? And be okay with that. Where a lot of clients would just go, I get it. And then later realize, no, I really didn't. I just didn't want to look stupid. I've heard that so many times. And I thought, no, this is your money. No one cares more about your money than you do. You need to be okay with saying, I don't know what you just said. Say it different. And I've had to say it sometimes. It's like, you're speaking a different language. Slow it down, please. And then they use different words and they teach it, and it's all good. So it's being comfortable and being confident and being in that place of just empowered to make those choices and ask those questions.
Thank you. Patty, what's the single most beneficial thing you've done with your finances, having been, you know, a single mom for, you know, divorced really early on, having an 18-month-old? What do you think has been the single most valuable thing or mindset or whatever it was that you have done that's given you that, you know, everything that you've needed in terms of financial stability and peace of mind?
I watch my finances very closely. I am a lifelong learner. So although this is a field that I know, I am always learning. I don't know everything about everything in the financial world. I just don't. And I am okay with asking the questions when I don't understand something. So I take it, you know, again, you know, no one cares more about my money than I do. And it's up to me to study it, to understand it. And then the other thing is, and this is for the younger folks, understand the power of compounding and the power of time, because the power of compounding and time yields you essentially your money working hard for you. And I don't like the word used, I don't like to use the term free money, but if you look at some of that math, especially if you're like in the 20s and you're just starting out of college, oh my goodness, you have time on your hand, and it's a blessing. So I did learn that early on. However, I didn't grasp it really enough to make saving aggressively the way I should have. So although I will say this, although I understood this from a very young age, I still made mistakes. I mean, that's just the reality of it. Especially post-divorce, you know, never make a big financial decision when you're not well emotionally. That's the other thing. You have to be, wait for, if you're newly divorced or newly widowed, please push pause on anything related to your money and wait until you are feeling better. You can make good decisions. I made some very poor decisions when I shouldn't have, and it was costly. So be very careful with that.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that, Patty. That's really, really invaluable. And I too knew about compounding many, many years ago, but, you know, slow to the game or just
life
gave thousands of reasons. Life wanted to live more, you know, the live today, worry about tomorrow, and tomorrow fast comes up when you're now in a position where you're in your 40s and you're thinking, okay, I actually want to retire at some point, or I want to semi-retire. I would like to travel and do more. And if I'd have done that more then maybe we'd have more choices. But, you know, no one likes to be told what to do by grown-ups, I think, when you're young. So you have to live and learn by yourself, by your own rules.
Very true.
It's been absolutely fantastic. You have shared so much wisdom with us, Patty. Please, can you share with our listeners how they can connect with you and find out more about your amazing work?
Yes, thank you. So my website is the best place to go. It's just my name, pattyhandy.com, pattyhandy.com. I do one-on-one coaching, and there's a free download on the homepage. It's a ebook and then like a mini masterclass. And it's Women Soaring Solo, is an ebook that I wrote. And you'll see all the ways to reach out to me. On my contact page is my calendar. So if you want to book a complimentary call with me, I do offer a complimentary 30-minute conversation. So feel free to use that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Patty, for coming on the show. It's been fantastic. It really has.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Sue. My pleasure. Thank you, Sue.
Congratulations for showing up and being one of the 8% that actually turn their dreams into reality. I appreciate you for listening, and I am committed to helping you improve the quality of your life. For more resources, make sure you check out the show notes underneath. Don't forget to hit subscribe and leave me a 5-star review. And remember, you are incredible. And if you dream it, you can achieve it.